Ah, the good old days, when life was simpler, things were less complicated, and you really knew your place in the world. This looking back is particularly comforting, especially when you have some sort of anxiety about the future and are not certain what's coming next, or you're unhappy with the way things are changing. I'm Charles Blue with the Association for Psychological Science, here today with Michael Wohl, who is looking into this connection between nostalgia for the past and anxiety for the future.
Hi, I'm Michael Wohl. I'm a professor of psychology and the chair of the graduate program in psychology at Carleton University, which is in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. I've been researching group-based emotions. So those are the emotions that you experience by virtue of group membership, right? So part of our sense of self is derived by our membership in groups. And there are some groups that you identify with more so than others. So for example, I'm what's called a highly identified Canadian, right? Part of my sense of self is derived by the fact that I'm Canadian. That ends up influencing how I think and how I feel. So I spent that extra $50 to get a Canadian flag on my license plates, a special kind of thing that you can do here in Ontario. But then when events impact that particular social group to which I identify with, it affects me. I feel emotions so I feel pride when I see the Canadian hockey team win the gold medal. And of course, what a stereotype, hey? I gravitate directly to hockey when I talk about my Canadian identity. See, that's what becomes salient aspects of my group.
And I think back to my days growing up in central Pennsylvania, the Amish country, and how good Scrapple tasted, realizing that it was probably shaving a few years off my life. Yes. All my friends will say, yes, we grew up eating that. It was wonderful. And it's a shame people don't eat it as much now, even though legitimately it's probably a good idea they don't.
Yes, yes. And in fact, some colleagues and I published a paper looking at social identity and food intake and how when one's social identity is made salient, you might gravitate to foods that are unhealthy for you. So it's called From Grits to Gravy, if you're interested in looking up that particular paper.
So we've got this idea of self-identity and group. How does this play into looking at the past, the nostalgia we feel for what our group was like 5, 10, 100 years ago?
Perhaps it would be a good idea to kind of dive into the purpose of the paper that brought me here to your podcast.
Jump right in.
Sure. So for the last number of years, I have been studying a group-based emotion called collective angst, which my colleagues and I have defined as the concern for the future vitality of your group. A lot of groups out there that are looking to the future and wonder what's going to happen to us, right? So, for example, Quebecois in Canada, to go back to one of my group identities being a Canadian, the Canadian province of Quebec, that Quebecois in Quebec, these are the French Canadians, are very concerned about the future vitality of their group. They're surrounded by Anglophones, and they end up acting in ways that manifest from that threat that they experience, right? So, for example, Quebec has passed a French language law that is aimed to protect the group's language because they're worried about what is the impact of being surrounded by Anglophones in Canada and the U.S. and English culture and what that might do to their group's future. There's other groups as well. There's been a lot of research on that in my lab and others that stems in part from a history of victimization, and other groups who have a history of victimization can sometimes develop what's called a siege mentality. That is that other groups are out to get us. And what does that mean for the future vitality of the group? And that ends up influencing how groups' attitudes and behaviors. So I've been studying this group-based emotion called collective angst for a number of years. And I've been interested in what leads group members to engage in either constructive or destructive behaviors in order to protect their group. So we've shown...
Could you define that just a little bit? What would you consider a constructive and a deconstructive or destructive behavior?
So a constructive response might be donating money to your group's community, right? So to promote the group, to ensure that the group's traditions are passed along from generation to generation, it can create group cohesion. But it can also lead to destructive behaviors if you believe that there's, for example, some external group that's causing your group's vitality to be undermined. Then you might lash out at that other group, or group members that you see are not behaving in a way that promotes the future vitality of the group. So you might see an increase in ostracism of members that people think are undermining the group's future vitality.
So you've investigated this whole concept of group angst. How did this play out in the paper? What was the conclusion that you came about, and what did it tell you that you didn't know before?
I think that it's important to first for our listeners to understand the purpose of the journal that I published in, Current Directions in Psych Science. Articles published in that journal allow readers to stay up to date on important developments in subfields in psychology and beyond their area of expertise or bodies of knowledge. Articles in Current Directions are also written to be accessible to non-experts, making them ideally suited to use in a classroom or teaching supplements. And with that in mind, what my colleagues and I did in this current paper is that we summarized recent research on collective angst that we've conducted and other people have conducted, and collective nostalgia, which is that sentimental longing for your group's past. And we wanted to emphasize that those two emotions are interconnected. And in the literature, what you see is researchers tending to look at emotions at the interpersonal level or the intergroup level in isolation. And what we argued is, no, these emotions can influence each other, right? And this is something that hasn't been well studied in the literature, is how one emotion could influence another emotion, which then has downstream consequences for people's attitudes and behaviors. So we put forth the supposition that the source of collective angst, that concern for the group's future vitality, the source of the collective angst that group members can feel can influence the content of the nostalgia that they experience. So what group members are longing for, which has consequences for the attitudes and actions that group members will support to protect their group's future vitality. Further, we argued that political rhetoric tends to capitalize on the relation between these two emotions to make specific existential threats salient, to elicit specific nostalgizing about the group's past, followed by promises to bring back the old days, okay? Days where perhaps that the source of the threat was ostensibly absent. So that's the gist of the article and what we were trying to accomplish, is showing that there's a relation between these two emotions, that angst can lead, so thinking about the future, right? Possible future threats might lead people to start thinking about the past and a past where that threat was absent, and how politicians may try to capitalize on that by trying to elicit specific threats in the populace, making them salient in order to achieve their goals of bringing back a certain past that may or may not have existed.
Well, that is certainly salient in the United States. We're beginning the final stretch of our presidential election. And the last presidential election really did hinge on this existential threat to what it meant to be an American and the promise of recapturing it, to bring that back. There is not quite so much of that, but are there any other examples? I mean, is this something that you've witnessed in Canadian politics and other ones? Certainly, most recently in the United States, it's been prevalent. But where else can we see this as having influenced the political process?
You know, if you take a look at political rhetoric, yes, I think the Make America Great Again, I mean, again, right? it's trying to elicit nostalgia in that phrase. But politicians use nostalgia all the time. Group leaders may try to capitalize on it or plant seeds of specific threats to the way we are, saying that, listen, things may change, right? So you mentioned Trump, and I know that the listeners of this podcast likely gravitate to Trumpism when thinking about this and the Make America Great slogan. And yes, this can sow seeds of unrest and discord, but it's also can be used as a tool for good. And we do see seeds of that. And we see, you know, in the United States and Canada and elsewhere, various politicians using nostalgic rhetoric. But it's not necessarily just for bad, so to speak. It can be used for good. So, for example, if we look back at some of former President Obama's rhetoric, he used nostalgia as well as a means to say that, for example, under the Bush administration, America had lost its way, had lost its ties to American values and traditions, and that America used to be a shining example, a signal to the world about values and virtue, and that a country that America used to be a country that respected each other, regardless of creed and color, and that America needs to be brought back to that, right? Part of the HOPE slogan is hope of return to a time when America's values and traditions of taking in people from around the world, regardless of creed and color, and where everyone could live as a one harmonious group, right? So we see nostalgia being used as a tool frequently around the world, and that it can sow the seeds of discord, but also to bring people together. And we recently had a paper, my colleagues and I accepted for publication at the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology, where we showed that there are different types of nostalgic reverie that can be experienced, right? One of a reverie of a more homogenous group, which is kind of a lot of the rhetoric that Trump tends to use, tends to elicit this kind of nostalgic reverie for when America was more homogeneous. And that's used as a tool to promote anti-immigration sentiments. But you can also elicit a nostalgic reverie for the past, for when society used to be more open, right, to other cultures and traditions. And that really is kind of the nostalgic reverie that Obama used. So when we think about nostalgia, you can think of it as a tool to help reestablish at least a perceived past that you're trying to bring back to the present.
Thinking back to the campaign work of President Reagan, George Herbert Walker Bush, Bill Clinton, my recollection of that, and that may be nostalgia on my part, was there was much talk about the bridge to the future going into the 21st century. There seemed to be much more optimism about what the future had to bring and that it would fulfill the promises that were made during the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And we were finally there. The younger generation was coming to the fore. It's almost like you're feeling nostalgia for the future because it's positive. That's unrelated to what you're talking about here, or is there some underlying connection to that?
I think that there is. I mean, you just finished saying about a connection to the past, right? So within your discussion about a hope for the future,
yes,
you were nostalgizing about the past, right? So I think that you were showing this interconnection between hope for the future, right? Mm-hmm. And finding a grounding in the past, right? Who do we think we are? Are we losing touch with who we think we are? A hope for the future is a real, is perhaps a hope for a realization of a future that has its seeds in the past. So there is an interconnection between the two. And I think nowadays we are seeing an uptick in the use of threats as a political tool. So our future is threatened. So it's not just a hope for the future, it's coupled with a feeling that that future is under threat. And remember how things used to be. If we could only reclaim what it was that we wanted to be and the way that we were in the past, then that threat that we're all experiencing, hopefully it would dissipate.
Now, the problem with that, of course, is that we can look at the past with rose-colored glasses, see it without its blemishes, and overemphasize the good and undervalue the bad, and also positive nostalgia for the past, nostalgia is, of course, is very group specific. So it might have been fantastic for one third of the population, but absolutely horrendous for two thirds. So this is actually really a very group specific dynamic you're talking about.
So this is what's, I think, one of the important contributions of the paper, as well as this recently published empirical paper, is saying that there isn't necessarily a specific past. Let's take a step back and think about the nature of memory. Our memory is not a snapshot of necessarily what was. It's not a repository etched in stone. Depending on a person or a group's psychological needs and goals, different aspects of the past may be selectively brought to light or forgotten. So within a particular group, you have particular psychological needs and goals. And so they are going to perhaps look at various aspects of the past, nostalgize about various aspects of the past that another part of the group might nostalgize about something very different. In a process called reconsolidation, nuances of past events can be lost and misinformation added. And thus group members and leaders in particular may consciously or not distort their memories in order to achieve specific goals. So this could be one of the processes that underlies polarization, that different parts of one group might perceive different threats to their group's future, which then ends up leading them to nostalgize about a particular aspect of the past that may or may not have existed. But they use that as a tool to say, we need to bring back those days.
And it could be, if you're saying this to 10 different people, they could all have 10 different versions, perhaps even versions that don't reconcile with each other, of the past. And they go, well, you're going to bring back the past. I like the past. I will follow you. But if all of those were to come true, it'd be both impossible and also probably conflicting.
Right. So, for example, nostalgizing about a more homogeneous society, right, when everybody was perhaps white and Christian, which of course was never the case in America. Or you could be nostalgizing about an America, a past when America opened up its doors to immigrants from around the world and took them in, and it was supposed to be a melting pot, right? America was founded on opening up its doors to people of any creed, religion, race. But was that ever true? So this is why I'm saying that a memory can be distorted and it can be used as a tool to help galvanize a group to take action in one particular direction or another. Whereas Obama tried to use it as a tool to promote more harmonious relations, to improve sentiments towards immigrants, Trump has used a different type of nostalgia that has had the complete opposite effect.
That's very insightful and not something that I think it's intuitive to many people, but what information is sort of missing? Where would you like to take this research? Is there some question or facet that has yet to be addressed that you think is important for our understanding of this group dynamic?
What we're doing in my laboratory right now is trying to understand the antecedents. What are some of the factors that predict whether or not one type of collective nostalgia will be experienced versus another? How can we up and down regulate various nostalgizing about the past to help create a more harmonious future where we can maybe down regulate some of the perceptions of threat that some group members experience that may lead to discord in a particular society?
Are there any other questions that relate to this?
Are you alone in feeling nostalgia? There's some really great research by Tim Wilchit and Constantine Sidakidis that shows that you're not alone in extent to which you nostalgize. That they found that approximately 80% of people experience nostalgia at least once a week or more. And if you break that down, about 20% report feeling nostalgic at least once a day. And about 30% report experiencing emotions 3 to 4 times a week. So the point, we often think back to days gone by and long for those days to return. And although historically nostalgia has been viewed in a negative light, we now understand that it can be very different. That descriptions of nostalgic reverie contain more expressions of positive than negative affect, and often depict a redemption of negative life scenes by subsequent triumphs. So nostalgia can really be used as a coping mechanism. What we've been trying to do is look at whether or not nostalgic is a coping mechanism for this collective angst. So the concern for the group's future vitality, that collective nostalgia is used to direct people for how to contend with this collective angst.
One additional topic I'd like to cover is, how does this relate to tribalism?
The idea is, my group is good, your group is bad. This plays out in many areas, from cliques in school to political parties to even science fiction community. Oh, you like Doctor Who, but I like Star Trek. Or the battle between Star Trek and Star Wars.
Yes.
It's rather amusing, but in some groups that can be important and heated and a part of identity.
One of the threats that group members experience is what social psychologists like to call collective continuity threats. And let's break that down.
Yes, I was stumbling on that a bit.
Social psychologists like to use complex phrases and terminology for sometimes very simple effects. But let's break down the notion of collective continuity. People tend to believe that although we grow and change, that there's a fundamental core that remains true. So the Michael of today is fundamentally the same as the Michael that exists, you know, the 6-year-old Michael, the 15-year-old Michael, the 25-year-old Michael, and I will not take us to the age of present day Michael. But although I have grown and changed and I've had a lot of experiences, there's a core me that traverses time. We tend to think about that at the group level as well. That the group, although the group has changed, shifted a little bit, there's a fundamental, a core aspect of the group that has remained unchanged. Troubles occur at the personal and the intergroup level when you tend to believe that the group is undergoing a fundamental shift, that the group of yesteryear is going to no longer be there, that there's such a radical shift in what's happening to the group that the group will be eventually fundamentally changed. And that is really threatening at the personal level when you think the self has undergone a fundamental change, or when you think that the group might have either undergone a fundamental change or in the future it may undergo a fundamental change. And that we've shown, that collective continuity threat, or what we like to say, we use the frame collective discontinuity, that there's a collective discontinuity, a fundamental shift, that's really threatening to people. And they don't like to see that. And they want to do everything that they can to make sure that there isn't a fundamental shift, that incremental change tends to be not that threatening, but a fundamental shift, a lot of group members don't like that. That's what elicits the collective angst. And we're also showing that collective angst that stems from that collective continuity threat, that's what elicits nostalgic reverie. You're thinking back to the way that the group used to be. This is who we were. We need to reclaim that. So the past gives you a path to reclaiming what you think the group is. And what you may end up seeing is group schisms happening. And so you have one group going off saying, nope, we're going to continue. And the other group says, nope, we're not. And then you have tensions between the groups. And we see that happening at the global level as well. And political leaders are very good at trying to direct a populace to say, this is our essence. Right? We need to reclaim this versus we need to reclaim this, or we can't change this, or else we're fundamentally altered. We need to go back to the way that we were. The successful politicians are very good at that. You'll see within speeches talking about threats, particular threats, the threats that Democrats are going to try to bring to the fore, try to get people to experience are going to be very different than the Republicans. Compare and contrast the threats, compare and contrast the nostalgic reverie that they're trying to elicit in order to direct people to behave in one way or the other. And, you know, voting for my party versus the other party.
We've been speaking with Michael Wohl, who has been researching this collective angst and how it plays into nostalgia. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. This has been a wonderful experience. And please feel free to have me back anytime.